This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Welcome. This is the fourth of the Great Decisions lecture series, five speakers. Our last lecture will be in 2 weeks and feature Christian Gunter of Celon Sustainability. It's a division of Celon Construction. He'll present Beyond Green, Responsible Property Investing Trends and Strategies. If you want a little bit more information, there's some flyers in the room right out behind those doors. You can find out more about that. It'll be in 2 weeks. For 55 years, Great Decisions has been coordinated at Whitworth University by the Political Science Department, which includes political science, cross-cultural studies, peace studies, and international studies majors. The series is designed to help Whitworth and the Spokane community better understand the world around us. Tonight, our topic is ripped from the headlines of what is happening now and likely to be a historical touchstone that marks an era of change. And our guest, David Woolman, has been a thoughtful witness to these events. Woolman is a prolific author, including his most recent book, The End of Money, which came out this year. He is currently a contributing editor at Wired. And he has written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Outside, Mother Jones, and Newsweek. A former Fulbright Journalism Fellow in Japan and graduate of Stanford University's journalism program, he now lives in Portland, Oregon, where he received the 2011 Oregon Arts Commission Individual Artist Fellowship. In 2008, Woolman went to Cairo to write about tech-savvy dissidents protesting against the regime. The activists that Woolman wrote about went on to play a central role in mobilizing and organizing the revolution that began on January 25, 2011. Woolman recently returned to Egypt to investigate exactly what happened. His account published as an e-book titled The Instigators, How a Small Band of Digital Activists Risked Their Lives and Helped Bring Down the Government of Egypt, is a dramatic behind-the-scenes tale that sheds new light on the tectonic events of the Arab Spring. Woolman was featured along with Net Delusion author Evgeny Morozov in a frontline special on the Arab Spring, and he has spoken about the events in Egypt to audiences throughout the country. It's from these experiences that David will present his lecture entitled Digital Dissent, The Origins of Revolution in Egypt, and the Role of Social Media in the Arab Spring. Please join me in welcoming David Woolman to Great Decisions.
Well, thank you all for coming. Patrick, thank you for the introduction. How am I sounding at the back? Can you hear me okay? I won't talk so fast. That is a problem for me sometimes, so wave your hands if necessary. So my plan for this evening is to tell you a little bit about the April 6th youth movement and how I became connected with this group and started reporting on them. And then what we'll do is sort of follow their trajectory up to and through the revolution. But I think it helps actually to interrupt the flow a little bit and read an excerpt from my piece, The Instigators, because it seems to set up pretty well two of the main themes that I hope to touch on. The first being that these events did not happen overnight, and that Egypt's revolution was not simply a sort of domino-like response to what had happened in Tunisia 2 weeks prior. And the second theme, of course, is the role of social media. How important or not so important were some of these tools? So to begin, the primary question really is, how did activists in Egypt go from this, which is a scene I will describe a little bit more. This is on the beach in Alexandria in 2008 when I was in Egypt. This is an activist group trying to kickstart a protest. How did they go from this to this? Alexandria, January 2011, actually a spot along the Corniche, very close to where we were on the beach a few summers prior. And of course, Tahrir Square. So the quick answer, the quick and dirty answer is slowly but surely and in fits and starts. And My connection to the group began back in June of 2008. I saw a very short op-ed in the Washington Post that was written by a human rights worker in D.C. who was trying to call attention to the fact that the Mubarak regime wanted to pass a telecommunications law that would essentially block access to Facebook. The reason for this proposed new law, or quote-unquote law, I guess crackdown would be a more realistic term, was because there had been a worker strike in the town of Mahalla. This is not a picture of mine, by the way. This is stock footage from that day. There was a worker strike there that had sort of metastasized into something of a street riot. And this was on April 6th, 2008. A few weeks prior, some young activists in Cairo had launched a Facebook page in support of the workers in Mahalla. And the group that they launched grew to 70,000 plus supporters in a matter of weeks. Now, for those of you who don't know what Facebook is, what does that mean? For those of you who do know what Facebook is, 70,000 people doesn't necessarily sound so impressive now that we live in a time when the latest band can have 70,000 supporters right away, let alone the latest viral video of cats doing nothing in particular can have 70,000 likes. So what does this mean? But you have to remember what the time in sort of tech history that we're talking about. Because in 2008, no one is looking toward the Middle East and the role of social media in all of this. We are, well, not only are we 2.5 years before the term the Arab Spring, but we are a year before the Green Revolution attempt in Iran. And we're at a time here where people are starting to understand that social media is more powerful than we might have thought at first when it just seemed playful. And especially at that time, people were looking at how the Obama campaign was using Facebook in very effective ways. But the idea that this stuff would matter overseas, let alone in these kind of social movements or political movements, was really anathema to a lot of people. So I read this like 600-word, very short op-ed calling attention to this international community, please stand up and do something about it. And all it did was leave me with questions. Because my job, as a feature writer, I'm looking for stories, not just press releases, not just updates, this mysterious thing called narrative arc, whatever that means. I saw this op-ed and I thought, well, who are these people? Who are these kids who launched this Facebook page? How do you grow a Facebook page to 70,000 people in a matter of weeks? What were these young people doing? What were the risks they were taking? What did they put on the line? Because the Mubarak regime was obviously cracking down on them. And one of the co-founders of this Facebook group had already been arrested. In the media, she had been dubbed Facebook Girl. All of this had kind of a cumulative effect on me. I thought, well, I need to pitch this as a feature story and get over there and find out what happened. So I pitched the story to my editor at Wired, and I should say, he deserves a lot of credit. In 2008, most eyes were not really on Egypt. There are just so many brush fires out there in the world that, especially at that time, we're talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, nukes in North Korea. Egypt, as far as anyone was concerned, really, Mubarak is America's best friend in the region and was right up until, early December, weeks before the revolution. So to my editor's credit, he ran it up the flagpole and the story was approved, and I flew over there in July of 2008. So my goal there was to meet with and shadow some of the activists and some of the main organizers of what they called themselves the April 6th Youth Movement. And one individual in the particular, his name is Ahmed Meher. He's the gentleman, I have the laser pointer and everything. Ahmed Meher. The sign behind him reads, "Welcome to the first dialogue meeting of the April 6th Youth Group." And this picture, I think, is significant for a number of reasons. A lot of the people present had never even met in the real world. They knew each other by their online aliases, and this was the first time they had gotten together. This is in an office in Alexandria, walking distance from the beach. Ridiculously hot, I should add. It was unbearable. These people are talking about Facebook as the headquarters of their movement, their revolution, really. But this was the first time they met face-to-face, and the idea was that they were going to go to the beach and hold a protest, hand out pro-democracy leaflets, talk to passerby on the street. It was actually a national holiday, so they thought they would have a better chance to generate conversation with everyday people. And they wanted to fly a kite painted like the Egyptian flag. This is the scene on the beach. These are the people they're hoping to spend some time with. And now we're in the vans trying to find a spot on the beach where security forces have not already swarmed. And during that meeting from a few slides earlier, which went on for quite a while, Meher is getting updates from lieutenants in the field about where state security officers have already landed, because word has completely beat them from Cairo to Alexandria as far as their aspirations to hold this protest. And so there's a lot of concern that really their movement is kind of this flash in the pan. After supporting the worker strike in Mahalla, can they do it again? Can they build some momentum? So now we're in the van looking for a place where maybe we can unload safely. And okay, what does safely mean? Let me take a quick time out. So in Egypt at the time, any unsanctioned gathering of more than five people could land you in jail or worse. You need a permit. And this is Mubarak's emergency law that had been in place for 30 years. This is how they do their thing. So right away, they're putting a lot on the line. Meher had already been arrested and tortured, I think in May of 2008. But he seems to be rather resilient to this intimidation. This is one of his lieutenants, a guy named Walid Rashid. I just quite like this picture because they're also not only sort of sticking it in the eye of the regime with their gathering and their obvious protest, but they're even wearing matching T-shirts representing solidarity of their interests. And this is trying to erect a kite. And this is a few minutes later. The kite hasn't even gone into the air. State security completely swarms. It's a terrible picture because I'm shooting from the hip and getting ready to get out of there. At first, it was not confrontational. A lot of state security officers show up. For some reason, they all seem to have an affinity for mustaches and short-sleeved polo shirts. So they all come in. They're all talking on their walkie-talkies, and they're sort of crowding around. And then the volume escalates, and then it just sort of fizzles. And people start to walk in different directions. That is when I saw these green army trucks coming down the street, which a lot of us saw, you know, during the revolution. We're seeing these images of these same trucks on CNN. So we're watching them coming down the road along the corniche. And the gentleman you saw in a picture a few slides back, Walid, who spoke some English, he turned to me and said, you know, they're coming for us, David. You have to get out of here now. And so I took his advice and I left. And it was after that evening, when I'm back at a hotel, that I learned what had happened. And that is that when the group had kind of splintered and the young activists are going to a few different cafes for essentially a debrief of what had happened and what went wrong, that's when state security jumps on them, not at the beach when everyone can see what's happening. So these vans speed up, you know, run over the curb. There's tackling, there's punching, there's kicking, they're screaming, where is Ahmed Meher, where is Ahmed Meher? They get his brother. They don't get him, but actually he spent the night in Alexandria because his brother was taken, and they got him the next day. But there are some interesting ideas about why he wasn't further tortured after that event. He was let out of custody pretty soon after. And one that I sort of write about is that, you know, his star had risen to such a degree that it was more costly for the regime to punish him more than it was to maybe let him free and hope that he's been intimidated enough to get back to everyday life, which, of course, he's not going to do because everyday life in Egypt is terrible for most young people. You know, the socioeconomic conditions are worsening by the year. And Meher, you know, he's a young civil engineer who really just saw a gloomy future for his young child. And so, you know, if he can't generate income, can't support his family, you know, these are the things that actually motivated a lot of people to participate in kind of revolutionary activities. So, what happens? I returned a few days later. I wrote my story. I was pretty proud of it. And I would say in the history of my journalism career, It seems to be the least read item I've ever put out there. You know, most people pick up Wired because they want to read about computer graphics for the latest Transformers movie and not necessarily about international affairs. Anyway, I did my thing. I also wrote about their gathering on the beach as basically a failure, because from my perspective, there was a sort of obvious, fast, swift, and incredibly successful crackdown on what they had attempted. But I learned a few years later just how short-sighted that understanding of the event really was, which I'll explain in a little while. So meanwhile, I'm back in the States, and the April 6th youth movement, they essentially went underground. And this is why I like this picture. It actually was taken in March of 2011. But let's just pretend it's 2009 because it signifies what's happening. They really went dark, but they didn't stop their activities. What they did is they went online. And Maher and his peers started reading the works of Martin Luther King and Gandhi. They're corresponding electronically with peers in other countries of the Middle East who have similar dissatisfaction with their own regimes. And they're kind of building a movement without telling anyone and without making it public. Then in 2009, one of the members of April 6th flies to Serbia, where he is going to attend a training session put on by a group called Otpor. This is a group that was started by some students there who very effectively use nonviolent protest techniques to overthrow the Milosevic regime. And what they did after that great success is they started essentially this thing called Canvas. I can't remember what the acronym is for, but it's almost like a summer camp for learning how to overthrow your local dictator using peaceful means. And so one of the guys flies over there to learn about some of these strategies. Again, trading information with his peers in Europe, with other people from the Middle East. They're learning, as Maher later told me, you know, how can we move from the keyboard to the street? That is a pretty important idea because, you know, I write for Wired, I'm interested in this technology, I am convinced that technology played a significant role in these events, but, you know, technology is a tool, and all of these activists will be the first people to tell you that people fill the streets and overthrow governments, not software and not mobile technologies or anything like that. And, you know, that's a very important point because I think there's this sort of this debate or fake debate about the relative significance of these tools. But when you talk to the people over there who pulled off this incredible feat, they say, well, no. It's just a powerful tool, but like sneakers. But we're ready for the next one because we've perhaps maximized the utility of those tools. One of the ideas that they learned over there, there's a guy named Mohamed Adel. He learned in Serbia and then brought back to share with his peers in Cairo is this idea of a dilemma action. And it's something I'll discuss a little bit later on in the talk, but the idea is that you put the state and the security apparatus in a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of pickle with a protest movement or a protest strategy. That is, if they crack down on you, they look terrible. If they don't crack down on you, you get away with something that they don't want you to get away with. So we'll come back to that idea a little bit. Excuse me. This is a picture of a gentleman named Khalid Said, whose story is quite pivotal to understanding the backstory, really, of Egypt's revolution. So this is where I want to read you an excerpt from the instigators to sort of bring us up to speed as we move toward January 25th. On June 6, 2010, a 28-year-old businessman named Khalid Mohammed Said was seated in a cyber cafe in his hometown of Alexandria. According to witness accounts, two local detectives entered the second floor establishment and began beating him. They slammed his head on a table before the owner told them to take the fighting outside. They pulled Said out to a building entryway where they kicked him and smashed his head against an iron gate until his body went limp. Official reports of the incident allege that Saeed was a drug dealer, wanted by police for weapons possession. He died, the authorities claimed, after resisting arrest and trying to swallow a bag of marijuana. But activists were quickly convinced that Saeed was killed for posting a video showing local police divvying up marijuana they had recently seized. It wasn't just activists, though. People all over the country, many of whom had no interest in politics, were appalled with official explanations they believed to be lies. After Saeed's family was called to the morgue to identify his body, a photograph of his horrifically mangled face was posted online. The image was too shocking for young Egyptians not to share. Mohammed Al-Anwar, a 22-year-old medical student from the city of Zagazig, later told me that Saeed's murder was somehow different from other episodes of torture and murder at the hands of the regime. Quote, "Maybe it was because he was this well-known and educated guy with many friends. And the picture, I mean, he was so completely disfigured. I don't know what it was exactly, but it spread like fire." A 24-year-old woman I spoke with in Cairo welled up as she recounted what happened to this man she'd never met. He was this good-looking guy who, by all accounts, was liked by everyone. It wasn't just the photo alone that was spreading, but also a Facebook page erected in Saeed's honor. A number of online memorials were posted, including one created by members of April 6th, but one in particular became a meeting place for tens of thousands and soon hundreds of thousands of Egyptians. A month after the murder, the page had 180,000 fans. They convened to vent, connect, pay tribute, and, although they may not have realized it at the time, unite. The page was called We Are All Khalid Saeed, and the title alone spoke to the sense among Egypt's educated but often unemployed youth that the corrupt state of the state was now everyone's business. The person who created We Are All Khalid Saeed chose to go by the moniker El Shahid, the martyr. Let me interject here briefly. As some of you probably know, this person who was concealing his identity at the time was Google executive Wael Gonin. The page's content was welcoming and interactive, with emotionally forthright conversations and a seemingly limitless string of thought-provoking comments and links. It encouraged visitors to share news, videos, and photographs about injustices suffered at the hands of Mubarak's security forces. And its creator took pains to keep the page as casual and unpolitical as possible, using, for example, the Egyptian Arabic of the streets, rather than the classical Arabic usually reserved for writing. The posts were drenched with earnestness. "We will triumph because we have no agendas, because we don't understand politics and negotiations and the dirty games of give and take. We will triumph because our tears are heartfelt, because our love is instinctive, because our dreams are legitimate, and because hope has now possessed every one of us." A few weeks after the murder, people organized vigils to honor Saeed. So here comes a dilemma action, by the way. Dressed in black, they gathered by the Corniche in Alexandria, facing the Mediterranean and on the banks of the Nile in Cairo, to observe an hour-long silent stand. Under a Mubarak-era law, any unsanctioned gathering of more than five people could lead to police custody or jail time. By standing at least 10 feet apart and staring out at the sea, the participants were not, technically, assembling. Just after midnight, on July 8th, the mysterious man behind We Are All Khalid Saeed sent an email to Ahmed Meher, using the alias Khalid Saeed. He began by praising the work of April 6th. "You are one of the first groups in Egypt to wake up, and hopefully this awakening will continue. And we can do something to change this country because we all have the same goal." He then complained about a newspaper report, crediting April 6th with organizing the silent stands. His objection, he said, arose from the fact that he'd worked hard to use the Facebook page to, quote, "attract many non-political people who do not want to feel that I am a political person or that this community is part of a political organization." But then he offered the hint of a pledge. If you would like to, consider me someone who is preparing a generation of young people to join you or anyone else afterwards. I want us to be one hand and to convince each other and to continue each other's work and positive efforts to change Egypt. So this is some of the behind-the-scenes correspondences that really is, at the root of organizing these events that, you know, most of us are watching on CNN. We think it was just this flash in the pan, and this is about 8 months before the actual event itself. Meher responded immediately, praising Saeed for his mobilization efforts and apologizing for the misinformation in the papers, adding that the error was not the fault of anyone within April 6th. Egypt's media at the time tended to tie any activities conducted by young people to April 6th, but Meher also pointed out that his group's involvement had helped magnify the demonstrations. Then he added, "This leads us to an important point. Maybe we can have a declaration between us, agreeing to consult, collaborate, and coordinate together so that young people will not be so scattered and afraid anymore during these protests." Without coordination, Meher explained, people brave enough to head into the streets often have to return home just as fast, having achieved nothing because, quote, one dumb officer shooed them away like flies. At 3:13 in the morning, Saeed sent his reply. I can't begin to describe how happy I was when I read your email. He appreciated that Meher was sensitive to the tone he was striking with the Facebook page. Police brutality, human dignity, freedom, these are universal issues, not political issues. Saeed did not want the agendaless brand of We Are All Khaled Saeed to be contaminated by an open connection to a political group. Still, he pointed out, you have probably noticed how on the page I am gradually moving them away from this fear of politics and subtly inserting some political subjects. I love that little piece. The two activists would trade a few more brief emails. Meher then suggested they continue the dialogue via either Gmail or Yahoo chat. The Google executive closed out the exchange. Our goal is one. I'll try to be online around midnight, but I only have Gmail. Meher and the person he knew only as Saeed continued chatting for months in the online world. On December 30th, 2010, Saeed wrote Meher in a chat session suggesting that they, quote, collaborate on a crazy idea. Meher, oh really? Crazy people are the ones that create change. Saeed, January 25th is Police Day. We want to celebrate it. Meher, cool. Saeed, we want to showcase positive and negative examples of police behavior. Meher, we celebrated it last year. Saeed, really? Send me any links so I can see what you did. They conferred about what kind of demonstration to conduct, and Meher reiterated the idea that the police were especially pissed off to have to work on Police Day. Again, dilemma action. Saeed wrote back, I can energize people to participate. But he needed Meher's expertise with information dissemination, publicity, and details about how to evade the police. It was soon settled. We Are All Khaled Saeed, now at about 500,000 supporters, would endorse and advertise a January 25th event, while April 6th would coordinate the logistics. So now we're into December, obviously, and some of the context that is crucial for understanding this kind of 10-car pileup of circumstances that led to the revolution. You have Mohammed el-Baradei returned to Egypt a few months prior. He is a Nobel laureate who inspired a lot of Egyptians, definitely more so kind of the educated upper class, but nevertheless, there was this sense that maybe, just maybe, political change was in the wind. Food prices, meanwhile, are skyrocketing, and this is just crushing for millions and millions of poor families in Egypt. And then on January 1st of 2011, there's a bombing at a church in Alexandria, kills almost two dozen people, injures 100 more. And the regime was very good at inciting sectarian strife, in that the idea being here, if the Coptics and the Muslims are not getting along and there's so much turmoil, you need us, you need the state's heavy hand to come in and control everyone, keep things stable. And, you know, if there's any word that's overused or was overused in that region, or in Egypt anyway, it was stability. And we will maintain stability. Trust us. Trust Mubarak. He's your father. And a lot of people weren't buying it. And, you know, there was a lot of suspicion that the regime was, in fact, behind the bombing of the church in Alexandria. And as far as I understand, that investigation is still underway, and it really looks like it's going to point to that conclusion, indeed, that, you know, this is all the regime pulling strings and trying to get, you know, not only killing Egyptians, but trying to incite this hatred among Egyptian people. Then, as we sort of start steamrolling into January, of course, Tunisia's Ben Ali flees the country, and Egyptians are watching what's happening in the neighboring country. Now, the story we get a lot in the mainstream media is this kind of domino effect, and absolutely what they saw happen in Tunisia inspired a lot of Egyptians. But there's one little side story that I like to share from my reporting trip last March, which is that Egyptians are also very competitive with Tunisians. And more than one person told me this on the streets in Cairo, that yes, they were kind of inspired by what happened there, but we also are very competitive with Tunisia, especially when it comes to soccer. And so we kind of felt like, well, man, if they can overthrow their dictator, we should certainly be able to do the same. And, you know, I enjoyed hearing that sentiment a little bit, I think because it spoke to sort of the youth of the movement itself. And actually makes me think right now back to Alexandria, that very first trip that I went on to watch this failed protest on the beach. As we emptied out of the vans, one kid jumped over the seawall and did this 360, you know, almost like he's on a skateboard. And, you know, they really were nothing more than punks at the time. And yet this thing they're doing is anything but prankish. So, okay, Tunisia, revolution happens. They are very competitive with their neighbors. Can we do this thing? By mid-January, April 6th, activists, the sort of core group, they call themselves the Kitchen, or members of the Kitchen. They occupy an apartment in downtown Cairo, not far from Tahrir Square, which they call the Operation Center or Control Room or something kind of cool and warlike like that. And there is a young woman named Asma Mahfouz who posts a video on YouTube that goes viral. You should really go watch it. I recommend it. She has this fierce expression. She's this petite woman with this kind of pugnacious tone to her. And she says, basically, to the Egyptian men, you know, men of Egypt, you know, I dare you to get off your butts and come out into the street and join us on January 25th. And this has a real galvanizing impact. I think sort of history will look back on her video clip as quite significant. Meanwhile, Ahmed Meher and his peers are coordinating very closely with other activist groups. And this is an important kind of timeout moment for me because I'm reporting very close to the ground about this one group and what they're doing and their collaboration with Wael Ghanim, and this kind of digital trail to the revolution, I think, is critical. But El Verde's activist group and, you know, there are groups more kind of left-leaning members of the Muslim Brotherhood, and there are all of these different factions that are sort of getting the sense that it's time finally to stand up to Mubarak. And so Meher is basically on the phone nonstop with all of them. Meanwhile, they are using digital tools to continue spreading their message and planning for January 25th. And what you're looking at here is a kind of how-to guide for peaceful protests. Carry a flower to signify a nonviolent sentiment. Wear leather gloves for picking up tear gas canisters, sneakers, water bottle, hat, hoodie, the rest of it. They are also posting online what they call, this is one of my favorite little details, but they crowdsourced a document on Google Docs that was basically just saying, you know, who are we? What are our demands? You know, this is Egypt's youth on the internet. Why are we doing this thing? And by kind of crowdsourcing it, what they're doing is they're letting everybody have a voice in it so that it reaches this kind of equilibrium tone, and that the points really speak for the most people possible. And so that even if there is a a wild, way out in left field perspective, or even if there's a state security infiltrator, that crazy suggestion, let's abandon the revolution, or let's stop using these tools like Facebook and Google created by the Western infidels. That was another one that was popular by the infiltrators. Those messages would get snuffed out very quickly by the majority sentiment from the young people who wanted to do this thing. One other point that I wanted to add about kind of how the revolution went down, Maher especially had an almost militaristic commitment to nonviolent protests. And a lot of this traced directly back to their training with Otpor and this idea that if you have 100 people on the street who are conducting a peaceful march and one person throws a stone or something like it, that one person will be in the spotlight of the television cameras. And they were acutely aware of this hazard. And so they're working incredibly hard to sort of spread that message, with the slide I just showed you, and also in planning how they will get out into the street and how they will pull people into the movement who aren't necessarily part of this kind of more highly educated, younger demographic. One thing that they did that was incredibly smart is they planned these very intricate marches through a blue-collar neighborhood in Cairo that eventually landed them at a meeting spot from which they moved on to Tahrir Square. So why is this important? Well, first of all, it's just kind of cool that they used Google Earth to map the street routes that they would use. And I've been begging Maher to find the copies of the printouts that they printed out things and they scribbled which routes they would take. And he said to me, we didn't know it would be a revolution, David. I can't find the paper for you. But someday it will be found, and I think we'll land in a museum. So what they did is they announced in the newspapers and more conventional tools of information dissemination that they would have a protest right after prayer at a very well-known mosque in a central area of Cairo. And state security can obviously see that this is the plan. And from the state security perspective, this is sort of an obvious place where young people from the wealthier neighborhoods of Cairo would gather for a protest. When in fact, the plan was that was not necessarily a decoy, but kind of a temporal decoy, and that they were going to show up there, but 2 hours later. When in fact, what they did is they dispatched about 8 or 10 teams or platoons of activists into a very poor neighborhood of Cairo, where they would all start in these back alley streets, gather people off the street, come down from your balcony, join us. They're not carrying April 6th flags. Everything is about the state. Only carry Egyptian flags, sing songs of, celebrating Egyptian statehood and pride in our country, and pull people into this march. So they're moving through the back alleys, bringing in people who aren't on Facebook at all. That right away, that's one of the instant criticisms you hear of this idea that social media mattered in all of this, is that, the majority of Egyptians don't even have access to the internet, and that's true. And the people who were pulling the strings behind the scenes, they knew that, and they found ways to reach out to that population. Writing messages on banknotes was actually another strategy that they used. So anyway, the idea is that they show up at the mosque. By the time they get there, they're 8,000-10,000 people strong, because what had been such a problem with them with their past attempts, is they would announce a time and place for a protest, and state security would be all over it. And so as people showed up at the mosque or whatever location, they're kind of plucked one by one, thrown in a van, and carted off. So what happened actually on January 25th is they arrive at the mosque en masse, which is novel in and of itself. But the other thing that was amazing that happened is that Maher was at the mosque, and he's kind of circling in his 1986 Fiat 128. Keeping an eye on state security, and people are gathering, everyday people who don't know the sort of secret ambush plan. They're in the thousands. They're responding to this ad for a protest in the newspapers, and there starts to be this kind of agitation about, let's go do something, let's move somewhere, and Maher and a couple of his friends are trying to keep everyone there longer, saying, wait, our friends are coming, and it's quite an incredible moment when he finally sees this wave of people coming down off an overpass, and he's getting calls from his friends saying, you know, we're 10,000 strong. And it's a, quite a moving moment for him. So the picture behind me, by the way, this is one of the downtown offices where some of the activists spent the night during the revolution. So now we're kind of in the thick of it. You know, there are these 4 to 5 days of terrible violence conducted by the regime. And obviously this moment many of us are familiar with when Mubarak decides to shut off access to the internet and telecommunication services, which turns out to backfire for reasons maybe we can get to in Q&A. But if you were ever writing, Mubarak should author a guidebook on, or a handbook on how not to rescue your regime when it's on its deathbed. Because, you know, telling thugs on camels to go hunt down journalists and shutting off access to the internet are sort of the worst possible ideas, because people now have, even people who aren't involved in this movement, now have no way to get in touch with their family and friends and loved ones who might be out in the street, or they just want to say hi to them and people they're worried about. So they have no choice but to take to the streets. So that was ridiculous on his part. So this is one of the places where they're sleeping at night, because, you know, they're certainly being targeted by the regime. Meher's, excuse me, Meher's 1986 Fiat 128, nicknamed Zazua, which he has since got, he told me he got a new car, which I'm a little disappointed about. He slept in this vehicle many times, not just during the revolution, but when he was trying to get other protests going as well. So I was actually in the mountains of Colorado visiting my in-laws when I got word via text message that Mubarak will go now, LOL, from Meher. And it was quite surreal and amazing to get that news from someone who no one knew of back in 2008. And I certainly did not forecast that these young people would go and achieve what they achieved. And you know, in 2011, their April 6th Youth Movement is nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. This is a picture that I took last March when I went back to report this kind of, you know, what exactly happened. And so this is at a shisha cafe in downtown Cairo. This is the scene almost every evening in Cairo with young people gathering around a shisha pipe and some 7-Up and laptops to talk about their futures. And this was the night before the referendum that was held last March that some of you may be aware of. This was kind of the first real vote for many Egyptians in a generation, you know, the first vote that would actually matter. It didn't go the way a lot of liberal activists wanted, but many of them are kind of taking the long view that, you know, a revolution is a process. This is Wael Gonin's words. You know, a revolution is not an event, it's a process. And so they understand the Muslim Brotherhood has this incredible organization that they don't have, and they understand that there's going to be a sustained fight to build a viable democracy in their country. But nevertheless, I like this picture also because it's exactly the scene I saw in 2008 in Cairo. Young kids sitting around with their laptops talking about what they might do next. And yet, this time, they had just overthrown the government of America's best friend in the region. The other thing that this photo reminds me of is Walid. Sorry, let me point. This is the gentleman who was so sweaty and speaking on his phone with the April 6th Youth Movement t-shirt in Alexandria, who told me to get the heck out of there when the trucks were coming. I asked him this night, you know, you guys have really come quite a long way since I first met you in July of 2008. Did you ever think it would come to this? I mean, that you would actually overthrow the government, considering how terrible that day was. And Walid is, first of all, he's like on a laptop and holding court with like 3 people because he's a very chatty guy. And so he's got like 3 conversations going on, and he's the best English speaker, so he's talking to me and he's typing into a Facebook page. He can't really hear me, so I ask it again. Like, going from that to this, amazing, right? I mean, that day was terrible. And he looked at me finally and he said, that day, you know, that day was beautiful. It was an incredible day. And I was completely confused. I had no idea what he was saying. I mean, they couldn't even get their kite in the air. Half of his, you know, half of the group was arrested, beaten, thrown in jail. What are you talking about? And he said to me, because of that day, we knew exactly how powerful we were and we are. You know, why did the regime mobilize this incredible counteroffensive against us? We had done nothing. We launched this Facebook page. We had these tiny little protests. They are so clearly scared of us. Not only did they give us free advertising all over Egypt by busting our tiny non-protest in Alexandria, but they're scared of us. And he said that, you know, and kept saying it was the most beautiful day. And I think that, you know, that comment was, you know, obviously revelatory for me, but it taught me a lot about kind of taking the long view on these protests. And I think that, especially in the digital age, we can't judge a social movement or a protest by the old-fashioned metric of boots on the ground and how many people are there in the street. Because people today, whether it's six of them gathered on the street or 60,000, when the sun sets and many people go home, they jump online and they maintain that sense of momentum and community and solidarity and bravery that brought them into the street in the first place. Whereas before the internet and social media, when you go home and you see that some people have been arrested or killed, and you see that you saw the tanks rolling in at sunset, for example, and you're anticipating that tomorrow is going to be even harder than today, or whatever reason, there's so many ways that people could, or movements could lose momentum. But in the digital age, you know, all bets are off in that regard because people can stay in touch. Ahmed Meher, number one, the guy never talks, really. You have to, like, pry it out of him. Number two, he does not smile very much. And this was a moment that I grabbed with Meher and his wife, Rehem, and they have the ink on their fingertips after just casting their votes in the referendum. And I think it's also worth adding, only because it's a really nice little literary point, that she was expecting that season, and she was due, her doctor told her she was due April 6th, and in fact, she gave birth a couple days later, but they named their son, the Arabic name, word is freedom for their son's name. So, in any case, what I want to do now is open things up for some questions, and I've definitely zoomed through a lot of material in 3+ years, but thank you for being so attentive, and I look forward to some conversation here.
If you could raise your hand, I'll come around with the microphone so that everyone can hear your question. So, any questions?
What is the video?
Yeah.
Her name is Asma Mahfouz. That's A-S-M-A-A, I think. Mahfouz is a terrible speller, but M-A-U-F-A-U-Z-O-U-Z, close enough. And if you get on YouTube, I think you'll find that pretty, certainly with your level of Googling skill, I'm sure you'll find it fast. And it's in Arabic, by the way, so you also have to learn Arabic quickly. But there are translated versions. I don't speak Arabic either.
Quality women are still a second class citizens. It's any of what's happened there that you've seen change that in any way, or is that continuing even in the face of social media?
Right. Well, with the activist groups that I was reporting on, you know, you can tell that that is an old world view, and they are much more about sort of an equal place in society for men and women. You know, I think that's sort of a breezy version, but close enough, because when you talk about the kitchen of April 60th, you know, it's a mix of men and women, and they sort of get that. But you're absolutely right that, you know, not only is Egypt still experiencing quite a lot of turmoil, but there are still, you know, I think from a Western perspective, it's safe to say sort of this inequality or disparity or discrimination when it comes to women's place in society. We're also seeing, you know, this was a point that I was hoping to raise. It's a little bit of a tangent, but it's worthwhile just because it illustrates kind of this ongoing turmoil. So when I went back in October, this was a few days after the state security, the new kind of military rulers of Egypt who are in place until there can be a parliamentary democracy, supposedly. They had cracked down on this protest of Christians outside the state media building and killed about half a dozen people. And again, this kind of like inciting strife problem, it looks like. Totally peaceful protest. The Coptic population was upset about how their interests were not being sufficiently represented, by lawmakers, and especially by the media, the state media, which is why they were outside of the media, state media building. And when I was there, one event that I just had time to cover was really smart on the part of April 6th. I feel like the Western media just, nobody covered it. You know, Egypt was back on the front pages again, and things are on fire, and that seems to be what grabs everyone. But, you know, the young people were so smart about kind of controlling the narrative with the revolution, and they are struggling to kind of get that back. But that night that I went to report this one scene, I thought it was a very savvy attempt on their part. So what they did, basically, there was a young man killed with those half a dozen or so outside state media. His name was Daniel Mina, I think. And he was a Christian. And so what they did is they arranged for Khalid Said's mother, the gentleman whose picture was up on the screen and who I read about, who was murdered in Alexandria. He's a Muslim. They got Khalid Said's mom and the mother of Daniel Mina, or Mina Daniel, I'm sorry, together to essentially mourn together. And they wanted to show the world that, you know, Egyptian people are not about strife or whatever kind of harmonious message you want to craft out of that. But, you know, it was incredibly moving, incredibly sad meeting to witness. But I thought it was also really smart on their part because they're trying to get that narrative back, and they're saying that is the old Egypt, the Egypt of sectarian strife, the Egypt of, you know, inequality between men and women, and, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. But it's so clear from the news reports today that, you know, they have a very long way to go. And in some ways, I think they've been quite frustrated, and there have been setbacks. I think Meher put some trust in some top army officials back when they were negotiating Mubarak's departure that I think, I don't know if he regrets it, but I think, you know, there's a sense that maybe they were stringing him along a little bit to kind of keep things peaceful. On the other hand, they did keep things peaceful, right? So that's another issue that comes up, because people at lectures are asking me, well, why isn't this working in Syria? You know, they have mobile phones, they have Facebook, and, you know, that's a very complicated question because these countries are different. But one way that is not a complicated question is that in Egypt, the army or the military was not willing to open fire on peaceful protesters. And in, you know, in Libya and now in Syria, it's clearly different. You know, there is that is a very clear line that sometimes gets crossed and sometimes doesn't. And you can see the impact of that. You know, the same in Tunisia. Anyway, I'm carrying on a little bit. Oh, I think it's a help. I think it's a huge help. Personally, as a journalist, you know, I hate that Al Jazeera English is not available widely to American audiences. Their reporting of the revolution was an order of magnitude more sophisticated and thorough than most Western media outlets. Every journalist I know was watching Al Jazeera live stream on their computer, not CNN on a television. So I think, you know, I understand some of the background to that kind of question, but I think, you know, sort of the aggregate effect of Al Jazeera is absolutely positive. Right. I mean, it was very, you can't spend time with these people and not have it rub off on you a little, the sense of hope. I mean, and perhaps I should be a little more jaded because I'm a journalist, but I, you know, it's just hard to spend time with them. So, for example, Maher, the night before the referendum, I'm walking through downtown Cairo with Maher, and we bump into a young guy from the Muslim Brotherhood, a sort of political leader in that group, who, by the way, is like in a sling with like this blood-drenched fingertips, like still recovering from his injuries from the revolution. And they have a little back and forth, mostly banter in Arabic. And afterwards, I said to him, you know, what are you guys saying? And he said, oh, well, we're voting different ways tomorrow, obviously. This had to do with revising the Constitution versus scrapping it. We can get to that at another point. Anyway, they're going to vote differently in this referendum. So they were giving each other a little lip about, you know, who's going to come hunt down who afterwards, or who's going to be disappointed tomorrow and who's going to be celebrating. And, you know, as we continued walking down the street, I think Mayer kind of sensed the moment just enough to say to me, like, look at us here in the street talking openly about politics. You know, he doesn't hate this Muslim Brotherhood guy. You know, he's worried about sort of a more radical wing of the Muslim Brotherhood seeking to turn Egypt into an Islamic state, of course. But I think a lot of them see a secular society as possible. The other piece, I think, that can't be overstated is the sense of economic justice that they are seeking, and economic injustice that they were so mad about. I mean, Mayer, he believes, of course, he and all of his pals, you know, that capital D democracy, they want all of that, all those high-minded ideals. What they really want is to be able to, like, earn some income to support their families, you know, and that's, you know, there's a sense for a lot of people here that tomorrow could be better than today. You know, that's why we are doing okay. That's why we don't have a giant revolution, or that's what leads to Occupy Wall Street movement, because a lot of people don't see that, right? But in a place like Egypt, no one was seeing tomorrow as even possibly better than today, let alone 20 years from now. And so that's when you see this kind of upwelling of anger, at least among this group. And this is where, going back to Wael Ghanim's brilliance, really, with the Facebook page, is this idea of attracting non-political people. This is a community. We believe in everyday ideals, universal ideals, and the magic of being able to corral all of those people and convince them to engage in what is ultimately the most political act there is, right? And so I think, again, you know, the motivation for being there, though, is kind of more everyday. You know, it's about like the price of tomatoes and a job. Oh, wait.
I'm just curious, what happens that people think
about? Wael Ghanim has a new memoir out called Revolution 2.0. You should read it. And so he was released. So he was kidnapped during the revolution. This was big news in the West, obviously, because there's the Google connection. But also it turned out he was the author of this incredibly important Facebook page. So I think, I don't know if it was 8 or 11 days or something, but he was abducted by state security apparatus, held. He wasn't tortured. But then when they let him out, and, you know, I write about this at length in the Instigators, but there's a lot of anxiety among the activists, not just April 6th, but different groups, that Ghanim, now this guy has incredible currency. And some of you might have seen this, but almost hours after he was released from captivity, he's on a TV show. He's on like an Oprah-type show, and he's bawling. And it had this another kind of galvanizing moment for the movement, because it had lost a little bit of steam after these like 7 or 10 days of camping out in Tahrir, facing down the thugs on camels and the whole bit. So Ghanim has incredible influence right at that moment. And there's a lot of fear among different groups, especially April 6th, that he will essentially grab the mic and go off message, because they were so careful to stay on message. Like, these are our demands. You know, Mubarak must go, end the emergency law that, you know, prohibits a gathering of 5 people, which, you know, they're doing from Tahrir Square, which is a gathering of thousands and thousands of people, and 1 or 2 others. And they were kept repeating that. They would not negotiate, would not negotiate. So they're worried that now he's gonna say something different. And they actually had some historical precedents for that nervousness, because a Facebook girl back in 2008, she was arrested for about 2 weeks, and then mysteriously, when she was released, she said, she kind of, I'm not sure what the right word are, but she kind of rejected the movement and said we were wrong, and kind of vanished into the shadows for a little while. She reemerged as an activist more recently, but that was a really difficult moment for Maher. And, you know, he attributed it to kind of the trauma of being abducted. So that he was worried that exact same thing would happen with Ghonim when he was released. What's he doing today? You know, he's on the lecture circuit and he's giving TED Talks. And I think he left Google. He started a foundation to promote something good. Social justice, pro-democracy.
You alluded to the movement somewhat, but can you read about the Muslim Brotherhood and all the things that are possible? And that was the editorial in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood about the Muslim Brotherhood and all the people that.
Well, you know, the first thing is I'm not based in Cairo reporting kind of spot news right now. So that does handicap me as far as having a real-time understanding of events there. But, you know, having said that, I'm consuming it from afar, and I do know some of these people involved. And my sense is it really depends what they do with their power. There's absolutely concern that the revolution will be hijacked if a more extremist branch of the Muslim Brotherhood turns Egypt into an Islamist state. It's just not what the majority of people camped out in Tahrir Square wanted. Now, the problem is they don't necessarily represent all of Egypt. But all of Egypt, you know, there's so many people who are uneducated and are terribly poor and have been seduced into thinking the state is their savior, the military provides stability, all of that, and they know the Muslim Brotherhood well. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood has this tremendous organization out in the countryside that activists don't have. But, you know, I respect people like Maher, you know, and his friendship with this guy I was just mentioning that he met downtown, you know, who was obviously a more open-minded member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And these are two young activists thinking about how to shape the future of Egypt. And, you know, that guy, I can't remember his name at the moment, but he's not someone who wants to steer Egypt in a radical kind of medieval direction. You know, and he might have kind of the Turkish model in mind, for example, of what their democracy could look like. But I am reading many times over this worry about co-opting the revolution, hijacking the revolution, failing the revolutionaries, and you know, I think, for lack of a better term, it would just be an absolute tragedy if it went that way. And that's not because I'm a fearmonger or any of that, but you know, democracy is not perfect, but. Well, you know, again, that Wired piece I wrote, it was like, just by the unscientific metric of correspondences from readers, it was like nobody read it. I mean, you write a short essay about creating a global currency or geoengineering, you know, sort of engineering huge climate systems to like battle back global warming. And, you know, people just are, they're flooding you with correspondences, you know, with all kinds of wacky ideas. And for the Egypt thing, it didn't feel like it made much of an impact. I think for Maher, it mattered much, a little bit. But again, you know, it's hard to know. He had been written about in the Washington Post a little before I got there because he'd been tortured. He'd been captured and tortured in May of 2008. So again, I think there's this aspect that his star is rising a little bit. And that might have been why when he was arrested in August of 2008, or I'm sorry, July, that he wasn't tortured and imprisoned for a longer period of time. But I don't know if, while I was there, my story hadn't even come out yet. So I know I definitely had no influence on that, but, it's just hard to know who's sharing what online, you know, I don't think that there are a lot of Egyptian people are passing around bootleg copies of Wired magazine. So probably not too much. But it was a real, you know, now it's just this incredible privilege I feel like I have to have known them then and to be able to kind of understand their trajectory a little bit more. You know, not because I'm necessarily more insightful, but because I was just there when they were just kids, you know, these punks, and nobody was paying attention to them. And, you know, when the revolution got underway, all of a sudden the media has to, like, parachute in all of these correspondents to, like, cover what's happening on the ground. And Tunisia just fell 2 weeks ago, and now it's Egypt. And, you know, I had this backstory. You know, and of course the story goes further back than 2008. You know, Meir and others are involved in protests, I think, starting in, like, 2004, and there are other upstart movements. But, you know, in a way, it's not really a surprise that this thing didn't come out of nowhere. But on the other hand, I still think that is not clear to a lot of people in the West. You know, what were some of the key ingredients that made this happen? You know, and then it became this tinderbox on January 25th. But it really wasn't just like that. Right behind you there.
So revolution is then happening across the world and social media. Do you dare to ask how this, obviously a revolution is localized on social media, how does social media change perhaps the whole tone?
The whole tone was the word?
Oh, yeah, the whole tone or other dynamics of the revolution, localization, and all.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, we talk about freedom of speech so much here, but I think the less sexy liberty is actually freedom of assembly. And this is the issue for Egyptians, you know, this idea that you can't gather more than five people on the street without getting thrown in a van. The internet, again, you know, it overrides that problem because you can, you know, now the proverbial barn that you're meeting in occupied France is, you know, it can hold 100,000 people, and there's no fear of death for participants, or, you know, they're not really in mortal danger by attending this underground meeting of the resistance movement in France because they're online, and the room can hold everyone, and everyone has a voice. And I think, you know, without being too Pollyanna about technologies, you know, that is incredibly powerful. And the people over there will tell you it's powerful, right? I mean, it's not just me. I think the kind of instant connectivity through text messaging is important. You know, a lot of this movement through the streets during their protests, you know, they're texting, you know, very quickly. Where are you? Move to here. I saw state security there. You know, but that's just the latest iteration of a communication technology that helps revolutions, you know, the telephone or the printing press, you know, it's getting the word out and getting it out faster, or getting it out to a wider audience. But, you know, it's incredible right now. There's another anecdote that I put in the instigators. The details are tricky, but one of the more, frankly, geeky members of April 6th Youth, he found a way to essentially blast these mass SMS messages, a massive text message to like 30,000 Egyptians through some weird discount that Vodafone was offering, to tell them about like this protest meeting on the street planned for a certain day. You know, that kind of thing is just like the ability to sort of not just use technology in that way, but kind of like see an opportunity and pivot really quickly and make great use of it right there. I think that's pretty valuable. Again, though, you know, when I was hosting this conversation with Meir and some others over there in October, you know, everyone just loves to say, like, did social media bring down this government? And they are just, like, shaking their heads, like, again, do I have to answer this? You know, Facebook revolution, that turn of phrase is just nauseating to most of these activists. Because, you know, again, it's a tool. You, people overthrow governments.
And a question, who locked Al Jazeera up again to try to debate this on people that have been through their power and is unbiased for these debates? another place.
You know, I don't know, I don't have an updated answer for you, but maybe someone here can jump in with a hand. But there is kind of this groundswell movement to lobby the, whatever they are, satellite providers or cable companies to make it available. I don't even have a television. I can't. I just watch stuff online, so I don't know exactly. But it's good. And some of that, you know, this might be a little bit too much of journalism sermonizing, but some of that is just the investment in having correspondents on the ground in those places, you know, as media outlets in the West become more and more cash-strapped. The first thing you do is recall some people from Cape Town and Cairo and Sao Paulo because, you know, you have to cover the story about the latest, greatest treadmill. And, you know, that's a problem. And so then when these big global events happen in a place like Cairo, you know, people are saying Al Jazeera's coverage is the best. Well, yes, they had like they had a bureau there. How are we?
Maybe one more question.
Even the biggest thing you can help with at the beach, and they told you it's probably the biggest. But the reason that we thought you might not have been able to get actually done in case of interviews and stuff like that.
No, I mean, so before we got to the beach, and this is like cutting room floor material because, you know, the hazards for me are not like what they are for people there, you know, and so for my Wired story, it's like, it's just a little too much on me, but they had like this 3-hour meeting, that, you know, welcome to the first dialogue meeting of the April 6th youth, and then we finally got in the vans to go to the beach, right? So during the meeting, I actually walked to this like corner shop across the street to like get some water and potato chips. And there was a guy there. We'd been watching him from the window. Walkie-talkie, orange polo shirt. And he's just in this chair, like leaning back on his chair against the side of the building. His job is to watch the window of the local El Had party offices. It's like another political party. And April 6 kids were using that office that day. His job is to like watch the window and like report back. What are they doing? When do they leave? So I walk in there, and he's like, who are you? Where are you from? You know, you look like Brad Pitt. He just said the stupidest things. I mean, it was ridiculous. But it was also clearly like, you know, we're watching you. And, you know, I'm not so cavalier. I was frightened by that some. But, you know, I sort of tried not to be and went back inside and didn't tell my wife about that till I got home. So that was a little bit off-putting. But then, like, the kind of in-the-moment stuff when the trucks were coming and, you know, that's a tricky thing for a journalist to, like, leave people who are taking care of him and who he wants to support on and report what happens to them. But, you know, they also, I think, felt a lot of responsibility for my well-being. So I think it would have been, who knows, other people might think differently. But I think it would have been less respectful to insist that I should stay with them no matter what. I mean, nor was I going to do that. You know, I need to come home to my family. So. Anyway.
Please join me in thanking David.
Thank you. Yes, I guess so. So I'm here for the Get Lit Festival in Spokane, so I'm on a panel tomorrow and then a book reading on Saturday. What's after tomorrow? Saturday? So I, you know, whether or not you're coming to my thing, I hope you'll support Get Lit, because from what I can tell, it's really a fantastic festival. Oh, well, that doesn't bode well for my talk at all. Anyways, well, thank you all again.